결혼아 고
결혼아 고
고 결혼아
고 결혼아
고 결혼아
고 결혼아
고 결혼아
고 결혼아
결혼아 고
결혼아 고
결혼아 고
결혼아 고
결혼아 고
결혼아 고
고 결혼아
고
Hi and welcome to episode 76 of Attention Please with Arnab Ray. We are recording this on 15th March India time and I'm Vikram Mohan. This podcast is sponsored by the Galaxy series of books by Aithal. The first book is Beyond the Milky Way, where three astronauts go to space in search of a planet with water. The second one, called Return to Earth, they come back home. Or have they? And in the final one, called Divided States of America, the mission is to fix a country that is divided seemingly beyond repair. You can find the entire series on Amazon as paperback and on Kindle too. So look for Beyond the Milky Way to get started. And we, of course, will have a link to the entire series on the show notes. We thank the Galaxy series for sponsoring all the videos and podcasts on the Talking Stuff Network this month. And now on with the show. And we've got a very special guest on today's show, and that's Dr. Pavitra Venkatagopalan. Pavitra has completed her doctoral dissertation, I got that right, on coronavirus assembly in 2012 from the Arizona State University. She is now in India, heading Care Health, her own NABH certified diagnostic center in Chennai and Bangalore. Welcome to the show, Pavitra. How are you?
Hi, Vikram. Thank you for the introduction. I'm well. How are you?
All good, as well as can be in, I guess, end times. And of course, it wouldn't be Attention Please with Arnab Ray without Arnab Ray. So, hey, Arnab, how's apocalypse treating you so far?
I'm alive. As you people know that I didn't do a podcast last week. So I'm back. I didn't do a podcast because I just didn't have anything to say. And then this week happens, which there's just so much to say. I've never been this terrified of the news as I have been in the last 1 week.
Because are you more worried about the lack of toilet paper, or are you more worried about the coronavirus infection?
No, I'm more worried about the fact that I live in a country where the president is absolutely clueless. And
that's a whole different podcast. Okay.
Yes, yeah, so that's a whole different podcast. It's really been the reaction of the U.S. government and the fact that the people here chose a reality TV show star because he was fun and, you know, he was entertaining to watch. And nobody ever thought that they would really need a president. I mean, nobody really thinks that they need a president till something like this happens. And then they realize the buffoon that they put up there and how totally incompetent he is. And that's what really worries me. Normally, I don't, as an engineer, I always think that leaders and managers are superfluous. I mean, ultimately, it's a doctor standing there who's going to do it. But no, not when you have a leader who actually gets in the way and lies. And so, but that's a topic for another day. Today, we want to focus purely on the science of it. So there's a lot of opinion going around. And of course, those who listen to this podcast know that there will be a lot of opinion, but that's not in this show. For this show, what we're going to focus purely on, because we have, you know, a specialist, a real specialist in the disease, specifically in the disease with us, we're fortunate to do that, is what we will be doing is rather than cutting out the more public health aspects and the more policy aspects and those things, fun things, you know, that we can discuss a lot about these, but that's for another day. Today, we'll just focus on the science of the coronavirus and the challenges of developing a virus, which kind of is a segue to the first question, really the biggest question that I had, which is, why does it take? Because I've heard that it will take about 18 months to develop a vaccine. Given that, again, forgive me if I'm getting the terms wrong, given that the RNA has been sequenced and people kind of know what they're dealing with, why does it take 18 months to develop a vaccine? Is it just bureaucracy, or is it just that is the amount of time it takes clinically to develop a vaccine? Please tell us a little bit more about this.
Okay. If we actually develop a vaccine in 18 months, I'd be very, very surprised. Vaccine development, if all goes well, it can take up to 10 years. There is a lot that goes on in the background. This is going to be a fairly long-winded answer. Now, we know the genomic sequence. That's just a lot of information, right? So we know that there are this many proteins and this is how the virus assembles. Now, coronavirus is not a new virus at all. It's been well studied from the 1950s. It's actually very well studied in animals because it causes a lot of economic loss if you have a pig farm or a turkey farm, or and it can be fatal in cats. So the virus is not novel at all. This particular virus is novel. So as for why it takes a lot of time to find a vaccine is, you have to find a vaccine, you have to identify that part of the virus that is seen by the body at the beginning of infection. Vaccines work by stopping an infection from happening. Basically, what happens in any general vaccine is, the body or the patient or every subject is given a viral mimic. Either it can be an inactivated virus or a killed virus or a particular protein that generally the body sees when the viral infection begins. If for that to occur, we actually know what protein it is that the body sees first. But the virus itself is fairly, it can change quite a bit if it needs to be. By quite a bit, I mean, when you look at the sequence, it might not be much of a change. It'd be like a really, really a minuscule change, but it can change the structure just enough so that it no longer is recognized by the body, which means the vaccine that you develop, keeping in mind a particular piece of the virus that the body might see, might just change a little bit. Then you have to go through the whole process of creating a mimic or a protein that now resembles the newly changed viral structure, which is not efficient. So this is a fairly technical answer, because the viral genome is actually RNA. Our genome is all DNA, which is very stable and it doesn't mutate often and things like that. While the coronavirus genome is fairly stable, it is made of RNA, which allows it a little bit more leeway into quote-unquote making mistakes. And these mistakes can either be advantages to the virus or it can be disadvantages to the virus. Usually, it's by a random chance that a mutation in the genome will cause a structural change that will allow the virus to survive against any evolutionary pressure that you place on this. Does that make a little bit of sense? Now, this is the technical part. Now, when it comes to a vaccine, there is what you call bureaucracy, but it's absolutely necessary to go through all the steps before a vaccine is given out to the public. The vaccine first, the protein mimic that you create, that you theorize in a lab, has to be synthesized, and then it is tested in animal models. In animal models, it's measured for immune response. That is to see if the animal model is, if the animal, the mouse or guinea pig or whatever is being used, is generates an immune response. If it does, great. Then you'll have to figure out how do you administer the vaccine? Do you give it as an injection in the muscle? Do you give it as a nasal spray? Do you give it as oral drops? So you'll have to figure out which method works. Then when you go into a smaller human population testing, you will check to see if these things work again as you expected if in the animal model, whether there is an immune response and things like that. Now, the next thing that needs to happen is the protein or the trial vaccine that we give to the members, is it toxic to us humans? We absolutely have to determine this, because if we screw that up, then the person that's being tested on will develop either a severe allergic reaction or some other outcome that we don't expect. The process has to be absolutely shut down. It not only has to have, you can't really test it immediately. For an antibody response, which is a typical response that you want for a vaccine, takes 6 weeks to develop. So that process itself is very time consuming. And this is the first level of trial. Then you have a second level of trial where you take a sizable population, like 1,000 people, and then do the testing. And all these things have to go through ethical clearance. Every single person enrolled in this trial has to sign off saying they agree that this is what they are doing and these are their health conditions, because we don't know what other infection that this person might have. And that might invalidate the data that you're trying to collect. Then if everything clears at this stage, you now test it in a population that generally... So let's say we test a vaccine for malaria. We'll have to go to a place that generally people have malaria too, because while it'll be very exciting to give the vaccine to the people and then give them the disease on purpose, it's ethically unacceptable to do that. So you will have to give the vaccine to the people that are having a high probability of getting the infection. And then you wait and watch and see whether these people, whether the rates of infection in that population is falling or not. Again, this is not something that can be done in a matter of a few months. This is about 100,000 people that's involved in a study. So this, and getting the people signed up, doing the testing, following it up itself will take a few years. So this is why vaccine development is such a long process. Recently, for the Ebola virus outbreak, they were able to administer a vaccine that they really didn't go through all these processes, because the virus is so brutal, they didn't think that it would be wrong to test it out on people, because if they're anyway going to die, we can at least see if it'll help. But that's not the case with this coronavirus.
Okay. So when you said it takes 10 years, and I understand some of the stages, is it because it has to account for all the mutations it undergoes?
No, that's actually not the case. A lot of the time that it takes is because of the logistics involved. Now, in case the virus mutates halfway through your vaccine testing, what do you do then? You have to start from scratch.
Okay, so it could be that the vaccine is developed and then it mutates and it's all gone to waste.
Yeah, usually that doesn't happen, but that is a possible scenario.
Okay, makes sense. So the second question that I had is, you know, based on the numbers, it seems that COVID-19 is more fatal than flu. And what exactly about this that makes it more fatal than the flu? Is it just because we don't have a vaccine for it?
No, not really. The flu vaccine is one of the most effective vaccines that is around, especially if everybody gets it. Gets the vaccine. That being said, this virus is a completely different family. Coronavirus is a completely different family from the influenza virus. So it's, in the viral world, it's sort of comparing apples to oranges.
Okay.
So that is one question. So the next perspective to look at it is, when you look at the case fatality rate, you can almost always not count it during an epidemic. You only come to know of it towards the end of an epidemic. We are right in the middle of the epidemic / in the beginning of the epidemic. It's actually astounding the amount of data we have, considering the first infection was identified on December 31st, 2019. A case fatality ratio, that is the number of people dying directly because of this infection, is the number of deaths directly attributed to this infection divided by the total number of people tested positive. Mm-hmm. Times 100. So that's how it is. But right now, we cannot get the denominator number correctly unless we test everybody. We actually don't know what the prevalence of the disease is.
Right.
We are only testing the people that have a higher risk or / have been exposed. So we actually don't know the total number of people infected. My strong opinion is that when there is not so much pressure on the healthcare system worldwide, and when testing is available more frequently and more easily to the public, we will actually find out what the prevalence of the infection is. Then we will be able to determine what the case fatality ratio is, or the death rate is, which I strongly suspect will be much lower than the current 3.5%.
That totally makes sense. If we don't know the denominator, and the denominator is likely to be higher rather than lower, then obviously the fatality rate is going to be less. Maybe it might even approach the level of the conventional quote unquote influenza. Okay, so let's go to the next question. It's again a question which this is a question that a listener sent in. It's sent in by Sridhar. He says that we just received news of the first patient being reinfected with the virus in Japan. Now, I don't know about this fact. I thought that perhaps they didn't test him properly. I mean, he wasn't reinfected. I thought that what I read was that he actually wasn't cured, but let's presume this is true. A first patient being reinfected with the virus in Japan, does this help us understand the virus better, and what's the impact of this?
Typically, if the person is not immunocompromised, they should not be reinfected. But we don't know how the person was tested the first time. I cannot comment. I don't know how the person was. I know how the person was tested the first time. I don't know how the person was tested the second time. Now, there are two ways of testing. Okay, the method that they're following now, which is an expensive, technically challenging method, is by real-time PCR. Now, that will identify an active infection. Now, people for other tests, if you know about other infections, they'll say IgG, IgM, which is an antibody response, which will typically tell you whether this person has ever had this infection or not. It might not be the current status of that patient.
Okay.
So I cannot comment on this without knowing more details about this particular case. Typically, though, once infected, if the person is not immunocompromised, they should not be getting the infection again.
Could you define what immunocompromised means in this context?
Immunocompromised is anybody that has a weakened immune system. It's typically children. It's typically pregnant women. Older people above 70 that have other conditions like diabetes, and people that have cancer and they're getting treated, people that have HIV. These are typically immunocompromised people.
Okay. So essentially what you're saying is that these are pretty border, you know, corner cases. It's, you know, older people with severe comorbidities, right?
Yes.
Okay.
So that is the answer to your question, which is basically, I don't know.
Okay. So the next question is from Nidhish, and she asks, why do some viruses like the flu get vaccines developed easily, but some like AIDS take years or decades? Is it purely a question of funding or the complexity of the virus? And maybe you've already touched upon this a little bit in the first answer.
It's not a question of funding at all. Influenza is a fairly simple, is a well-studied virus, and we know typically what happens every season. What happens is it starts coming out from the southern hemisphere. So quickly in the northern hemisphere, people see what strains are coming. What are the two proteins that are required to cause an immune reaction? Very quickly develop vaccines for it and start selling it to the rest of the world. That's what happens with influenza. And we know how to grow it, how to inject it, and things like that. HIV is a whole different beast. Now, it's one of the simplest known viruses. It has only 7 genes, but the virus is so error-prone that it can escape in any number of ways. One is, like I said earlier, it escapes by changing its structure just enough that the vaccine doesn't work. The other one is how it infects the cell. The HIV virus infects directly the immune system. A robust immune system is needed to mount an immune response. That is whether from an infection or from a vaccine. So because this virus happily takes over the immune system itself, it's very, very challenging to develop a vaccine. And so many trials have gone. There was a recent trial that had to be shut down because they were not seeing the effect of the virus. HIV vaccine development is one of the most well-funded areas of study that involves all the major health international health organizations. But the virus is just that difficult to tackle.
Okay. So, a kind of follow-up question that I had, and you talked about there's no problem with funding. How lucrative is the business of developing these these vaccines? Because I read somewhere that contrary to what people believe, evil pharma, quote unquote, that there isn't really a big business case for developing things like it's for something like COVID-19, which possibly might go away in a few years. I mean, there's a good business case for influenza, but not for COVID-19. I mean, is that correct?
Yes, because when was the last time you heard of a coronavirus infection that lasted so long? Or when was the last time you heard of a coronavirus infection before this virus came along?
Right. So wasn't one of them the MERS? Wasn't that a coronavirus also?
Yes, but if you look at the number of people that have it, it's on a global level, it's highly insignificant. Even though MERS has a very high mortality rate, the number of people that get it is insignificant. If public health measures can control the infection, there is really no need to go through such an expensive process of developing a vaccine and then administering it. As for the lucrativeness of developing a vaccine, a lot of companies cash in on vaccines that are given successfully worldwide. Like polio vaccine, when the labs make it, they make it and sell it to the government. But they know that the vaccine works, they no longer have to do R&D on it. Mm-hmm. So in a certain way, yes, it is highly lucrative, but only for certain things. It doesn't work for all viruses or all infections.
So one thing, again, I read is that COVID-19 is specifically, I wouldn't say the word dangerous, because that kind of negates my point, is it's not very dangerous. It's at that nice level. It's at that, you know, the virus has kind of calibrated itself perfectly. If it was too fatal, then people would just die and not, and there'd be nobody who would be getting it after it. So it's at that right level where it can infect the host, but it's not that severe. And that it has way more number of people who can transmit it than people who actually get it.
All successful infections are like that. HIV, TB, malaria are all like that.
So wait, so what you're saying is with HIV, there are people who get it, but they don't have any symptoms?
No. The thing is, the person can lead a relatively healthy, unsymptomatic life before they actually like fall really sick. 2-3 years without any intervention of drugs, but the person can still lead a relatively normal life for 2 or 3 years. And that is a good enough time to spread the infection to others. It's not like you're exhibiting any symptoms.
And in that respect, MERS wasn't particularly successful. Like I'm guessing.
Yes.
So it was like Baghi 3. It didn't do a lot of good business. It just went too much, went too intense. You know, it just sent Tiger Shroff to Syria is just too much. That's a line.
It's just too much to handle.
Yes, too much to handle. So that's MERS. Okay. And it's also that MERS is Middle East, and that's okay. Well,
yeah. Good okay. Example. So, like, coming back to a serious answer, 2002 had the SARS virus outbreak. That was the previously well talked about coronavirus infection. Now, that had a mortality rate of 10%. And that took a lot longer. That took 9.5 months to control. And that was easier because only people that showed symptoms were spreading the infection, which means if you had a cold and a cough and you tested positive, you kept isolated. Now, with this coronavirus, a person is spreading the virus even if they show no symptoms. That is what makes it challenging.
So even though SARS had a higher mortality rate, but this one will possibly have greater number of people who died just because they'll be more infected?
Yes.
That definitely makes sense and, you know, doesn't do anything to make me not panic, but let's move.
Exactly.
So the public response to this is a lot more, has a lot more to do with the panic and the mob mentality than the seriousness of the infection itself. Now, the social distancing, I think we'll get to this topic anyway, but I'll talk about it right now. The social distancing thing is very effective, not in stopping the viral infection, but in reducing the rate of spread. So let's say we are going to have a total of 100,000 infections, right? Whether the 100,000 infections occur in 10 days or 10 months, makes a big difference in how the healthcare system can take care of the patients. So if you're not overwhelming the healthcare system, then people can be handled better and possibly have better outcomes.
That's the flatten the curve which everyone talks about now.
Yes.
So is that flatten the curve true? Because I also read a Medium post which says that is not true. So not that I could understand the Medium post, but I generally can't understand any Medium post. So that's okay.
But that's a different thing. But forget about a Medium post. But if you just think about it yourself on a logical thought process, the fewer, even if you're going to get it, just get it a little bit later, no?
Die another day.
What is this mad rush to get everybody infected all of a sudden?
But here's a question which follows up on this. It's kind of a little public health question, but you know, how is this sustainable? Like, okay, so right now my daughter's schools have shut down for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Okay, we might have flattened the curve for a little bit, but this is obviously not something which you can keep on doing for, let's say, 3 months.
That is a call that the public health officials have to take, because you don't have, so let's say your child can't go to school and the child is sitting at home and both the parents are working. You're essentially looking to put the child in daycare or work on a loss of pay. Neither of them are sustainable.
Right. So my question is, wouldn't just at least what's happening in the US, and I'm pretty sure that's happening in other countries too, are we actually flattening the curve, or are we just kicking the curve down the road? So that the curve will happen, but it will happen a few months later.
So when just we'll
hopefully be a little bit more prepared.
So just because people are saying don't, keep on have your social distancing happening, doesn't mean everybody is going to be listening to it. We are going to have that uncle that says nothing will happen to me, I need to go. So the people that are getting the infection will continue to get the infection. It's just that the rest will get a little bit later. It would make sense I don't know how they're going to let things return to normalcy. If it's in a tiered fashion, then if the rate of new infections is sort of maintained steadily, then the healthcare system can handle it.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it's just going to be scary for everybody involved and ineffective.
So, that's kind of makes sense, and there'll always be people who will not be obeying because they don't want to or because just they can't.
Right.
Yes. So there's a question which Rachit asks. He says, I practically have a menagerie at home, birds, rabbits, a cat and 3 dogs. Is there anything I should do to keep them safe from us and vice versa?
Just follow your usual hygiene practices. Literally just follow your usual hygiene practices. One second. Sorry, my child is standing on a ledge and threatening to push himself off. Now we are all right. Nothing. Now, there is not much you can do. Hand wash, keep their poop clean, keep their cages clean. Just follow what you normally do. Because in an infection like this, which is spread by droplet, literally, or if you see a higher rate of infection, the only thing it reflects upon is how well you keep yourself clean and how clean people around you are.
So just a point of clarification, I thought dogs don't get this COVID-19.
Yeah, they don't get COVID-19.
Okay. But the birds, rabbits and cats do?
No. I don't know if it's been tested in those hosts. But what I'm saying is these precautions are universal. It has nothing to do with COVID-19. You don't have to be scared of the animals, nor should the animals be scared of you.
That's a big relief, at least in my home.
Yeah, I mean, just follow your usual hygienic practices. That's really all I go around telling people. Suddenly I'm talking to a whole lot of people and I'm like, please wash your hands. And the comments on those interviews, they say, what a waste. She only says, wash your hands. I'm like, that's really all you can do.
You're supposed to prescribe pills. I mean, don't you know that's what we need in India?
Yeah, of course. I can prescribe Gaumutra also. And it'll be effective. But okay.
Do you want to go there, Arnab?
No, we're moving topics very quickly. Let's move. The next question, please.
So the next question is, what is the state of testing centers in India and how long would it take for a diagnostic center like yours to be able to test for the virus? So this is with respect to India. I don't know if you're aware of the problem with the US and if that's something, because we have a in the US, there's a huge testing problem. And right. other countries have done much better than that. So if you could throw some light as to why, first of all, what's India doing? And secondly, why did US screw up so big time on this?
I have no idea why the US did what it did, because apparently everything the previous guy did is wrong and this guy is doing, he takes no responsibility for it. So I don't know about that. As for India, they say there are two aspects, two ways of looking at it. One is, if you allow everybody to test, am I still audible?
Yes, you know, absolutely.
Yes, you are.
Okay,
yes.
My screen sort of changed a little bit. Let me go back. Going back to the question about what, there are two aspects of looking at having access, to giving access to everybody for testing. Is there are two ways of looking at it. One is, if the government has control over the testing and the government takes priority in handling the critical cases, then they are easily able to track the patients that come in and contact their contact people and then figure out how the infection spreads. So, and these are done in highly controlled conditions. That is, the testing is done by very, very technical people in a well-qualified lab. So now let us say everybody has access to this testing. In one aspect, everybody that has a cold and a cough will get a coronavirus testing done, which is great. Absolutely. For me, because I'll make a lot of money out of this. But there are no great kits available for testing that will be so specific and accurate for this test. Now, my lab, personally, we are capable of developing it, but we don't have the permission to do it. Now, what happens if there is a lot of false positives that are given out by irresponsible labs? If it puts everybody in a state of panic, right?
When you say you don't have the approval, hold on.
We don't have the approval. Even in India.
Approval from whom?
Approval from, I actually don't know, but I'm not authorized to test. You need to be an approved testing center H1N1. You need to have certain facilities like a biosafety level cabinet of 2 or 3 and then an isolated room and things like that. These are good things because then lab-based spreads will not occur. I am fairly certain that in a few months, they will be approving labs for testing COVID-19 if they have these kinds of facilities. So yeah, that's my answer. So,
that'd be the NABH which you...
No. NABH is a voluntary accreditation that has nothing to do with the testing approval. I actually don't know who I get testing approval from, but we will get a notice from the different departments, state departments of health, saying you're allowed to test and you're not allowed to test. Typically, we get the information from the Department of Health from each state.
So when you said specific enough, could you just explain a little bit? So you said there could be a lot of false positives. So what technically is going on for which there isn't a specific, very specific test?
Okay. So
I thought everybody has a specific test. And that's not true.
No. So there are kits available. Kits. These are commercially available kits, meaning you add A, B, and you should get C or not get C. That's how it works. That's the easiest way of doing things. So how this test, COVID-19 testing currently works is based on the genomic sequence. This has nothing to do with the antibody response. When that testing kit comes along, that would make it much more easy for everybody to have access to it. But currently the testing is done by this method called real-time PCR. PCR works on DNA. And I already told you that the COVID-19 virus, coronavirus genome, is RNA. So you first have to work to convert the RNA to DNA and work in such a way that you are not introducing any inadvertent mutations into the sequence. Okay? Which can happen. It's not uncommon. Then you take this and then you have to amplify. You have to identify specific regions that are only specific for COVID-19 and not any of the other known coronaviruses that infect humans. There are many known coronaviruses that infect humans. And you have to identify that sequence that absolutely does not exist in any of the other coronaviruses. If there is even a little bit of a screw up in this, then you could be identifying a whole bunch of other different coronaviruses that a person might carry. Now, it's important for me to mention here that 1 in 3 common colds is caused by a coronavirus. So the virus is not as rare as you think it is.
Okay.
COVID-19 seems to be new and novel and more severe than other coronaviruses, but coronaviruses actually cause 1 in 3 common colds.
Well, that's interesting. So this health kit, this kit that the WHO kit that I keep hearing of, which other countries are using, so you're saying that also is prone to inaccuracies?
No, the problem with the WHO kit is given on a government to government basis. A private party will not be able to purchase it. A WHO kit is absolutely extremely well validated if people are following the correct protocols.
Okay. So that I understand it. So the WHO kit is proprietary to WHO. No private lab can develop a clone of it. It's their own secret sauce. And they give it to governments. Now private labs can do their own thing, but then that has these problems.
Yes. WHO has already done the validation to know that their kit works really well. WHO actually does not have a secret sauce. They have even if you copy it, you still have to validate it in your lab. And there is a lot of processes to get it validated. WHO is actually very open about all their protocols and testing. In theory, it should be very easy to replicate it, but molecular biology is its own beast, and what might work yesterday will not work today, and you can't attribute it to anything other than the position of Donald Trump's hair. So,
okay, because that's one thing which I personally don't understand is that why the US did not use the WHO kit.
I have no idea what the US policies on clinical testing are. So I'm going to refrain from comment.
Okay. So that's all the questions that I have for you. Do you have any other questions, Vikram?
Well, we do have one which has come in from Twitter, from KyatoB. That's the handle. And I'm not sure whether, honestly, I'm not sure if Pavitra is the right person to answer it, but Kyatobi, feel free to cherry pick whichever parts of the question you want to answer, Pavitra. But okay. Kyatobi asks, what are the after effects once the patient has recovered, or as they say, is there or is no longer showing the symptoms? Are they more susceptible or too weak?
That depends on how they started off. If they are relatively healthy, that is not having any of the other conditions that I had previously talked about, they should recover just fine. And it will be like having any infection. And depends on the severity of the infection that they had. If the COVID-19 infection was mild in them, they will continue to lead a normal life once the infection has been cleared from the system. If it has been fairly harsh, then your body has taken a beating and it will take a while for you to recover.
All right. There's we had this conversation a while back, you and I, but I just wanted you to even tell our listeners what you told me. When I asked you, I think I asked you whether, you know, there's a lot of talk about this being a bioengineered weapon and all that. And you told me that, you know, nothing can bioengineer as much as nature. So
Right. Would
you want to expand on that a little bit on why this can't be a bioengineered weapon?
This is not a bioengineered weapon because there are very clever people who are working with the sequences available, and they've actually identified the specific date on which the first animal to human transmission even occurred. So this is very technical, but there are people that track origins of infection. What they do is they do contact tracing, which is, okay, who did you get it from? Who did you get it from? Who did you get it from? And then they go back to see what the earliest identifiable case was. Now that is the human transmission aspect of it. Now, coronaviruses came from an animal source to humans. I'll expand on that a little bit later. But what they have done is they have identified the first possible case and then found out the environment that this person has been in, and this person has been exposed to bats. And they've isolated the coronavirus that is closest to COVID-19 from the bats that in the same environment that this person was in. So this is absolutely not a lab engineered virus. While I won't say biowarfare doesn't exist. Biowarfare exists, but coronavirus, this COVID-19 is not a lab engineered virus, and there has not been a single case of a lab engineered microorganism that is more virulent and pathogenic than what nature has thrown at us.
Right. So, that makes
so it's true that somebody did eat a bat, because I heard somewhere that was.
No, please. We as humans are highly xenophobic. So it's very easy for us to blame someone that seemingly does something very different from what we do. I keep going back to the same example. In 2017 and 18, India had a Nipah virus outbreak. How many Indians would be enraged if I say, oh, Indians got Nipah virus because they ate bats, which is not true. So a viral infection is very probabilistic. How an infection is initiated is a protein on the virus will interact with a protein on the cell surface. And if it is able to use the protein on the cell surface to enter the host cell, it will. So that's basically what happened. In any place with a lot of human and animal contact, these viruses would have come and seen, okay, let me go see. Oh, I can't infect. But suddenly one of these viruses have a mutation that is like, oh, I can infect a human, and then it's gone into a human. That's pretty much what happens at the start of an infection.
Okay, so patient zero, so from what I understand is that it was serendipity that patient zero came in contact. It could have been just flew by, touched a bat. Or was in a place with a lot of bats. And there are many places, caves and stuff.
Yes, there are bats all around us. Around you right now, around me right now. We just don't see it.
And then that specific strand of RNA basically mutated to be able to make the jump from the animal to human.
Yes.
Okay. So most of these pandemics that we deal with, is that usually the origin that, you know, something from the animal basically jumps out?
Yes. A lot of these viruses are zoonotic, meaning they've come from animals to humans. It's like Tinder. Like, you keep swiping, I don't know, left or right, you keep swiping one way, it is like, finally, doesn't work, and suddenly it works. That's sort of how it is.
Okay, that's, again, not that I would know anything about Tinder, but okay.
Me neither. All of us are happily married here. Let's move on.
So, is that our show for today, Arnab?
That is our show for today. There is a one question that I had, which was, again, it was a question which is addressed to me, which was, how do you guard against the extremes of panic? And, you know, so I'll ask that question to you, doctor. How do you guard against, and I know this is not your specialization, but it's a general question. How do you guard between the extremes of panic and, you know, nothing will happen?
It is hard, because you're thrown all these flashy news every day saying nothing is in the grocery store and so many people got infected, and you can't help but react. We are all humans. On some level, we sort of have to either succumb to the panic and stock up on toilet paper, or be like, wait, let us see actually what happens. Let us follow the rules. Let us follow the suggestions that have been given by the public health officials and take a measured response for what we need to do. The funniest thing that I have found is people buying masks. It's like, what are you going to do with a mask? Nobody knows how to use a mask. People are like, oh, it's a 2 rupee mask. I've spent 20 rupees on it. Let me keep it in my pocket and use it for 1 week. You're doing nothing to anybody with that. You're just carrying a gross mask with you.
By the way, we had a function in our daughter's school yesterday with very select, I think they just said 2 people per student, which in India, I guess it's a very restrictive number. But one of one of the things that notice mentioned is that all of us should wear masks. And of course, nobody did, including me.
Yeah, masks are completely ineffective. Wearing a mask doesn't just mean wearing a mask. It means wearing it properly. If your nose is going to itch, if you scratch it, the mask is useless. I know a lot of people that wear masks that cover their mouth and sometimes chin. Like, it does nothing. Your nose is exposed. The only people that know how to use masks are usually doctors and frontline healthcare workers. And by hoarding all the masks, we're actually preventing them from having access to these masks. Wearing a mask and getting used to wearing a mask for hours on end is training. We are not trained to do that. Now, where is a mask effective? A mask is effective when a person is sick and wants to reduce their spread of their infection to another person, provided they use it correctly.
So when the virus enters, which is the path that is most common? Is it through the mouth, is it through the nose, or is it through the ear, or
this particular virus seems to be entering through the nose and the mouth. We haven't eliminated the eye, and we also know that this virus comes out in our stool. So, which is why hand washing is your first and biggest line of defense.
Okay.
We wash our hands, we keep it free of the virus as much as we can. And I don't know if you know this, we actually touch our faces about 20 times a minute. And mm-hmm. our face is where all the soft tissue is. Our eye is soft, our nose is soft, our mouth is soft. And if your hand is dirty, then it can easily get transmitted to the body through the eye, nose or mouth.
Man, this is so difficult.
It's really easy. Just wash your hands. Just wash your hands and don't touch your face.
Yeah, but that touching the face, as you just said, 20 times in a minute. I didn't know the stats, but that
I literally was touching my face when you said that, so I'm freaking out a bit.
It's hard. It is hard. We have to fight against every instinct that we naturally have. How do we cough? We cough into our closed fist, and then we shake hands with the next person. It makes no sense. WHO has a recommendation for how you should cough and sneeze.
Yes, you should cough into your shoulder or something. That's
shoulder or elbow, yeah. And it doesn't come naturally. It doesn't come naturally to me. I'll cough once into my hand and then the rest into my sleeve.
You end up looking like Count Dracula or something, right? When you do the elbow sneeze.
Yeah, that's pretty. Yeah, that's true if you look at it that way. I mean, I think of myself as Batman, but cool.
So the last question that I had is, I've been hearing is something which Trump likes to say, and it's mostly nothing better than WhatsApp forwards, but that this will all go away once the temperature rises and becomes summer. Is there any truth to that?
We don't know. If you look at the seasonal flu, it spreads during the colder seasons when the temperature is low and the relative humidity is low. Whether this will also behave like that, we have to see, because so far it's still winter in most of the places. Even if the temperature increases, the rate of infection would reduce. It would not stop.
Okay.
So I don't have an answer to this question. There are some studies that shows that higher relative humidity and warmer temperatures reduce the rate of transmission, but it is not going to become a complete zero.
Okay. So it will be there, but its rate of propagation, it will have to work against that factor at least.
Yes, yes.
Okay. It's mildly reassuring. So
okay.
That's mildly reassuring. So those are all the questions that I had, Vikram. So.
All okay. right. So that's our podcast for today. And thank you, Pavitra, for joining us and clarifying
Thank you, guys. I had so much fun today.
I'm still freaking out a little bit, like I said, since I was touching my face all along, but I guess that's okay. And Pavitra, like I said, runs Care Health in Chennai and Bangalore. Anything you need to plug?
No, that's really it.
And to our listeners, while you're under lockdown or quarantine and are just bored out of your mind, consider listening to our other podcasts. Search for Binge On, our podcast that recommends stuff to watch online and keep you busy. And WhatsApp Geeks, our podcast on everyday technology. And after that rather tasteless and shameless cross-promotion, I think we've come to the end of this episode. So until next time, keep washing your hands and stay safe.
And one more thing, don't be a Manoj Kumar. Don't touch your face.
No hand to the face. Yes, absolutely. Yes. thank you all.
Okay, guys.
Okay, bye-bye.